Hi, everyone. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome to the West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, also known as WUF. I'm Brad Hewitt. I use the pronouns he and him, and it's my delight to be your lay leader this morning. I bid you welcome. Whether you're here in person or watching online, you're welcome in this place, regardless of the color of your skin, the amount of money you have, the job you have or don't have, the home you have or don't have. We affirm your spiritual practices, and we affirm if you have none. You're also welcome, regardless of whom you love and how you identify your gender, if you do. And you are welcome, whether your heart and life are full, or if they're empty and you're hurting right now. We're so grateful you are part of this time together in our beloved community of conscience and compassion. I want to especially welcome newcomers and visitors, whether you're with us here in person or visiting online. In just a few housekeeping items, I'm happy to share, if you're not aware, that today is our board made the masks optional at WUF officially due to the continuing low COVID risk levels. So yay for that. For those of you on our mailing list, please look for an email from Reverend Tracy that came yesterday with much more information around that. Anyone not on our mailing list may contact the WUF administrator via our email website, or excuse me, our WUF administrator email. Visit our website at WUF.org with questions or to be added. During the service, if you feel more comfortable downstairs where there's more space to move around and also fun things for kids to do, you're welcome to watch on screen from there. Don't forget, we're having our in-person coffee hour following the service, and I've heard there are a couple of tables today around Measure 114 for gun safety in Oregon and a table for get out the vote outreach in swing states for the upcoming election. If you're watching from home, also please consider joining the virtual coffee hour at 11:30 using the Zoom link that's in your email with your order of service. This week's announcements are attached to that email as well, so you can learn what's happening here at WUF. As I mentioned before, if you'd like to be added to our email list, please email administrator@wuf.org. One more reminder, if you haven't already done so, please put your cell phone in airplane mode or turn it off so we're able to provide a better streaming experience for those of us joining from home. Today's chalice lighting is called Who We Are Called to Be, by Pat Uribe-Lichty. Our chalice is a reminder that in hard times, our ancestors of faith acted in courage to bring hope and safety, to bring life itself to threatened people. We light it today as a reminder of who we are called to be in a world still dangerous and despairing. With courage and faith, we bring ourselves to the work before us. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful and what is wondrous. Let us open our minds to learn what is true and what is mysterious. Let us open our hearts to love one another and our neighbors. If you would please join me in our affirmation of gratitude and giving. Let us be grateful when we are able to give, for many do not have that privilege. Let us be grateful for all those who share their gifts with us, for we are enriched by their giving. And let us be grateful even for our needs, so that we may learn from the generosity. Now, please take a moment. Close your eyes. Settle into this moment. Feel the support of where you are sitting, the floor, the earth. Sense the presence of those people around you, whether in the sanctuary, your home, or the homes near you, and of the beings of all kinds of life that surround you. Know that you are part of that web of life, and you are not alone. Sharing our joys and sorrows draws us closer as a community. I invite you now to call out those people, events, or other items you're grateful for and release that good news to the world. Our practice, since we're also live online, is sharing joys and sorrows now by placing a stone in the bowl of water here in front of me. These stones cause ripples in the water that spread just as sharing our sorrows helps to ease the pain, and sharing our joys multiplies the good. If you choose, please come up from my left and go back down the aisle on the other side after placing your stone. If you're online, you may choose to type your joy or sorrow in the chat or share it with someone in your life. And now Howard Baldwin will have a few words for us.
In preparation for the seminar that Bruce Poinsett is going to give us in a couple of weeks, we wanted to have this introductory day to talk about white privilege and why it was important. And I wanted to find a couple of readings. So, of course, you know, when you look for a reading, what do? You Google white privilege. And I came up with something that really astonished me. It was an essay called Understanding White Privilege. It was a part of a book called Men's Lives. And it was, I guess, part of an essay that said, Work Clothes and Leisure Suits, the Class Bias and Bias of the Men's Movement. And it was from 1989. We need to be clear that there is no such thing as giving up one's privilege to be outside the system. One is always in the system. The only question is whether one is part of the system in a way that challenges or strengthens the status quo. Privilege is not something I take and therefore have the option of not taking. It is something that society gives me. And unless I change the institutions which give it to me, they will continue to give it, and I will continue to have it, however noble and egalitarian my intentions.
Now we'll have our time for all ages video.
Ron's Big Mission by Rose Blue and Kareen J. Naden. You're up early this morning, Ron. What's the rush? Asked Mrs. McNair. Come and have your breakfast. I made some oatmeal. I have to go, Mama, said Ron, tying his sneakers. I have something to do this morning. You always have something to do, said his mother with a smile. Just be home by lunchtime, okay? Ron was 9 years old. That morning, he left his house with a plan. He'd been thinking about it for a long time. It was a beautiful South Carolina summer day, and Ron looked up at the blue, blue sky. Someday, he thought, he would be up there flying a plane. He wanted to be a pilot when he grew up, but today Ron had something else on his mind, something very important. Ron walked down the street as fast as he could. He didn't want to be late. Hi, Ron, the grocer called from the front of the store. There you are, just in time for a donut. Morning, Mr. Douglas, said Ron. Thank you, but there's someplace I've got to be. And Ron kept on walking. Down by the schoolyard, Ron saw his friend Carl shooting baskets. All right, you made it, called Carl. Hi, Carl, said Ron. I wish I could stay, but I've got something important to do. More important than basketball on summer vacation, said Carl. Are you kidding? Ron laughed. He loved to play basketball, but not today. Today was too important. Ron kept on walking. When Ron got to the Lake City Public Library, he stopped. This was it. He was hot from walking so fast, and he was nervous, too. He took a deep breath, lifted his head high, and went inside. Mrs. Scott was busy getting ready for all the people who would be using the library today. As the head librarian, she had to make sure that everything was neat and orderly. Mrs. Scott looked up to welcome her first visitor of the day. She smiled as Ron walked in. He was her best customer. Ron gave a little wave to Mrs. Scott and went right to the shelves. It took Ron a while to find some books. He always looked for books that showed children who looked like him, but that was hard. There were not many books about black kids on the shelves. At last, Ron found some books on airplanes. He took the books and started to walk to the front desk. Ron felt nervous and his hands felt a little sweaty, but he knew what he wanted to do. Mrs. Fielding, a white lady who was often in the library, stopped him. You can give me the books and I'll check them out for you, Ron, she said gently. No thanks, Mrs. Fielding, Ron said. I'm going to do it all by myself. But Ron, she started to say. Ron was already on his way to the front desk. He put the books on the counter. I'd like to check these out, please, said Ron. The desk clerk didn't look at him. Didn't she hear me? Ron wondered. Ron knew what he had to do. He jumped up on the counter. He wanted the desk clerk to know he was serious. I'd like to check out these books, he said quietly. At first, the desk clerk and Mrs. Scott just looked at each other. You know you can't check out books, Ron, said Mrs. Scott. You can read them here. That's the rule. Only white people can check out books from the library. Ron looked at Mrs. Scott and the desk clerk politely, but he would not budge. I always read them here. Today, I want to check them out, said Ron. Mrs. Scott and the desk clerk did not know what to do. Ron wouldn't get off the counter. People were staring. Finally, the desk clerk called the Lake City Police. Two policemen came right over. Let someone check out the books for you, son, said one of the policemen. You know the rules. But Ron just shook his head. He would not budge. Now Mrs. Scott called Ron's mother. Mrs. McNair came to the library very quickly. I know how you feel, baby, she said, but you have to follow the rules. I can't, Mama, Ron told her. It's wrong. The rules are not fair. Why can't I check out books like everyone else? No one said anything. Not the desk clerk, not Mrs. Scott, not the policeman. Not even Ron's mother. Mrs. Scott looked at Ron. She thought about all the times that Ron came into the library and all the times he sat at the tables for hours looking over so many books. He was her best customer, and she knew what she had to do. Mrs. Scott walked back into her office and started writing. Ron wondered what she was doing. Mrs. Scott returned and handed Ron a library card, his library card. Ron looked at Mrs. Scott and smiled. As he jumped to the floor, he thought he saw her smile too. I'd like to check out these books, please, he said, handing the card to the desk clerk. The desk clerk took his library card and stamped the cards in the back of the books. These are due back in 2 weeks, she said. Ron smiled. Thank you, he said. He tucked the books under his arm and took his mother's hand. Together, they walked home. Ron couldn't wait to get to his room and open to page one. Author's note, the boy who was Ron McNair grew into a man who flew planes just like he dreamed he would do. He became an astronaut. Today, everyone in Lake City remembers him. They remember him every time they walk into the library. The red brick building on 234 Main Street is a special place. The walls in the children's room were painted with pictures that show children reading books under a huge oak tree. A space shuttle flies through the sky. Inside the library, anyone can get a card and check out books. Young Ron McNair had a dream. On that day in 1959, he made it start to come true. Because of him, many young people have a chance to dream. You can only be a winner if you are willing to walk over the edge, astronaut McNair once told a group of children. You're eagles. Spread your wings and fly to the sky. Many years ago in Lake City, South Carolina, young Ron McNair became a hero. Years later, in 1986, astronaut Ron McNair was once again a hero. He lost his life when the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded on January 28th, with the loss of the entire crew. The Lake City Public Library is dedicated to astronaut McNair. The story is a fictionalized account of a real incident in Ron McNair's life. There are several versions of this story. This version comes from interviews with Ron's mother, the late Mrs. McNair, and Gloria Wilson, administrative assistant to the Director of Library Systems in Florence County, South Carolina, and Gloria Tisdale of the Lake City School District. We thank them for their help in reconstructing this inspirational story. Except for Mrs. McNair and Ron, all of the character names are fictional.
I'd like to ask Howard to come on back up, please. And
so before I introduce Bruce, I have another reading from a book that was extremely fascinating to me. I think that nothing embodies white privilege than the way that we have dealt with housing in the United States. And so when you talk about privilege, you talk about real estate, and there's a book called The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein, which is absolutely fascinating, laying out how we got to where we are. This is from The Color of Law. Racial segregation in housing was not merely a project of Southerners in the former slaveholding Confederacy. It was a nationwide project of the federal government in the 20th century, designed and implemented by its most liberal leaders. Our system of official segregation was not the result of a single law that consigned African Americans to designated neighborhoods. Rather, scores of racially explicit laws, regulations, and government practices combined to create a nationwide system of urban ghettos surrounded by white suburbs. Private discrimination also played a role, but it would have been considerably less effective had it not been embraced and reinforced by government. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Bruce Poinsett this morning. I've met Bruce through the work of my wife in Respond to Racism and Lake Oswego, a group that was founded by Bruce's mother, Willie. Bruce is a writer, educator, and community organizer whose work is primarily based in the Portland metro area. He hosts the Blacktastic Adventure, a virtual exploration of Oregon's black diaspora. A former reporter for the Scanner News Group, his work has also appeared in the Oregonian, Street Roots, Oregon Humanities, and Eater PDX, as well as projects such as the Mercatus Collective and the Urban League of Portland's State of Black Oregon. Poinsett also contracts with the University of Oregon Equity and Inclusion Office and numerous Oregon nonprofits, as well as teaches journalism and creative nonfiction with literary arts writers in the schools, the WITS program. In addition to his professional writing work, Poinsett also works with Respond to Racism LO, a grassroots anti-racism organization in his hometown of Lake Oswego, Oregon. Please welcome Bruce Poinsett.
Thank you so much for that intro, Howard, and good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So again, my name is Bruce Poinsett, he, his, and I will be hosting a workshop called Repurposing Your Privilege on October 15th, I believe, from 1 to 4 p.m. So I hope to see many of you there. And I came here today to give you just a little preview of that. So the thing about this workshop is, more so than anything else, the goal is, how do we use the privileges afforded to us, the privileges we bring into the room, to advance justice and fundamental change? Even when it comes to, we looked at unjust laws, as we looked at a number of examples of that today. And even that story of Ron McNair, it kind of moved me a little bit, so sorry if I'm a little caught in that. But to get back to the presentation in a couple weeks, I started with a disclaimer that I want to share with you all. So, what this workshop is not for: teaching you how to avoid uncomfortable conversations, improving your social justice rhetoric for the sake of building social capital, providing you with a shield from accountability, maintaining the status quo. What this workshop is for: accepting discomfort as a part of the process of creating social change, fostering a culture around systemic power redistribution, improving your ability to identify areas where you can make a direct, meaningful impact, holding yourself and others accountable for ethically engaging with this work. So share that disclaimer, because some people hear that and they think, yes. But I know other people hear that, and it feels like a little bit of a challenge. It can scare some people off. But I want to encourage people to embrace that challenge. So I'll share a little anecdote with you about a day that changed my life that doesn't have to do with anti-racism. I played basketball growing up. In spring of seventh grade, I got invited to play on two different teams. First team, I go to the practice. as other my fellow seventh grade classmates. It's pretty straightforward. Maybe we ran some lines, but for the most part, we just played basketball. And I looked around and said, I should be the best player here pretty easily. Second team, I go there. We don't even meet on the basketball court. We meet in the weight room. I've never been in a weight room in my life at that point. I look at the kids around me. Some of them are other seventh graders, but they're the seventh graders I remember from being on, you know, the big traveling teams. And then the other kids, they're eighth graders. One of them, fun story, would go on to play in the NFL. So when you want to look at disparities disparities and just looking there and saying, oh, this is different. We did a lot of running. There was a lot of yelling. And I knew that if I was going to be there, it was going to be maybe the toughest challenge I had faced at that time. And that's the team I chose to go with. It's a team that helped me grow. And it's how I look at this work, a lot like exercise. Sometimes we get caught up because it's serious. Anti-racism, very serious work. And we get intimidated by it as opposed to looking at it as, again, opportunity for growth. Opportunity to, in a way, again, not to trivialize, but to like work these muscles, to work on these thoughts, to keep building. It's a lifestyle. It's not just you come to a workshop, you come to a training. This is something where, yeah, I hope to give you some tools that you can use, hope to help some of you maybe think differently than you thought before. But most importantly, it's about what you do after this workshop in 2 weeks. So with that, I'll tell you a little bit about myself and where I come from, because I think the experiences we bring into the room are, how we show up is important. So as mentioned before, I grew up in Lake Oswego, Oregon. The nickname, some of you may know, Lake No Negro, Oregon. And it's earned. I have a litany of stories. We're not going to go through all of them today because that could cover the whole 3-hour workshop, honestly. But things I remember, you know, being in kindergarten, there were two children of color, myself, student Mohammed, who was an exchange student from Saudi Arabia. When it came time to teach us how to read, let's say you had the students up here in the front, they put us in the back and had us play with blocks. Come, you know, the night where we do show off our reading for our fellow students and our parents, I was fundamentally illiterate, and it's a night my mother especially is still fuming about. I'm 33 years old, mind you. I had people, you know, touch my hair, reach out, grab my hair, play with my hair more times than I could ever count. I had people just come up to me and be like, I didn't know you could talk like that, because I didn't sound, I don't know, like a music video or something that they saw. I remember playing basketball in high school. Every few years, like Oswego will usually make the news for some terrible moment, either at a basketball game or a football game. In our case, we played Lincoln in the state tournament, and the black player went up to the free throw line, and our student section decided to chant, "You can't read," and hooked on phonics. Yeah. So, as that, again, that was during my time, but I still work, as mentioned before, with nonprofits, anti-racism organizations, specifically with Respond to Racism, LO. And one of the things I'm very passionate about as a former student is working with students. So one of the things that's very distressing to me is the stories I still hear, the things that still happen with students. You know, a couple years ago, I think, there was a student who was suing Lakeridge for just a whole racist environment, but specifically it kind of stuck with me because this student was also a basketball player. And I understand that, you know, one of the things that gives us the opportunity to escape in these spaces is like sports and extracurriculars. So in addition, people always say, well, you know, why don't you fight back? Why don't you fight back? And when you do, one of the things that stops a lot of people is the fact that that cuts you off from all these things. Sports is an option. Even going to school, you're going to deal with retaliation. Sometimes it's from staff. Oftentimes it's from students. It's ostracizing, it's isolating. I get numerous complaints when it comes to cops in schools, or they call them student resource officers, but you find yourself trying to advocate for a family and then always realizing you're not just going against, you know, one SRO who's a bad actor. You're going against the whole system every time. And watching people just be demoralized and beaten down by that over and over and over again. I got one incident. They said a student who had transferred for maybe a week, a black student, was arrested in the school in front of all his classmates over, allegedly, over a past shoplifting offense, maybe. Not from at the school, but just something the SRO looked up. There is maybe some of y'all saw, because I know this one made the news. There was a family who, they had severed deer heads left in their yards next to their Black Lives Matter sign. That was, I think, right before the 2020 election. So this is still very much there today. It's still very much the same environment, which is why when I come into this work, I don't want to sound jaded, but at the same time, you know, I look at all the energy after the summer of 2020. I look at people when they say, you know, I was so moved by the George Floyd protest. I was so moved by the anti-racism protests of the summer of 2020. I look at all that excitement, all that energy, but then I come back to what has materially changed. Because if this is just a moment for the pictures, for the photos, so we can say we did it, then what did we really do? And I always come back again. I look at children who grew up like myself with a place like Ello with considerable privilege, never mind those that didn't, those who don't. There's so so much struggling happening right now, both material, also very much psychological. How do we materially change that? And one thing that, you know, one way you look at it is saying, what do we have that we're working with? Again, what are the privileges we bring into the room? I grew up in Lake Oswego. I grew up around, I was able to be comfortable. I was able to have some experiences that I could say, I can recreate that for people that didn't have it. I'm in proximity to people with power and political capital. How can I extend that not just to people in LO, but outside, especially outside? How can I get other people into the conversation? Because, again, I'm 33. I'm a freelance writer, not exactly rolling in money upon money here. But funding everything, everyone I work with, everyone I see doing great work, what's the need we always come back to? Funding. resources, personnel that is willing to do what is needed. And that's a lot. People who are willing to not just show up, but show up with intentionality, show up with humility, show up with, again, a willingness to do what you need to do. Respond, we often say, you know, step up and step back. Knowing when it's time to, you know, tell you with myself, for example. Even doing stuff like this, like I've done speeches, things before, but it's relatively new. It's a thing I didn't really, really pick up on until it became a need and realizing, oh, people get something from seeing someone who looks like themselves up there and speaking on these things, speaking on their experiences, and then saying, okay, I can do that. I can facilitate these things if I need to. I can learn what I need to learn to be a better facilitator, to be a better, you know, just person in front of the stage. It's not my natural mode. It's not my natural MO. But it's what's needed. And it's not just about, you know, the performance up here. It's the thing we see. We see the pictures. We hear the speeches. So much of this really is about unsung work. It's about doing the things that just, not to get into the nitty gritty, but it's just what makes the infrastructure work. And it's, again, a lot of it comes back to discomfort. I don't want to give anyone the idea that it's like, oh, if I go through this workshop, it's going to be fine, it's going to be smooth sailing. We want discomfort, and not just for this, but again, going forward. And a big part of that, especially when we talk about white privilege, is this idea of decentering whiteness. And it's something, again, in the society we grow up in, it's something we never think about. We don't think about how things are normalized. We don't think about how even just pointing out whiteness, talking about whiteness, is, you know, not a new thing, but just a maybe a jarring thing for people. And that's good. So, again, I know some people, when they hear that, like, yes. Other people, it's a little skittish. But I just want to close here, and I feel like I'm rambling a little bit, and saying that I want you all to embrace the challenge. I hope to see many of you on October 15th. And really, really come with an intention of embracing anti-racism as a lifestyle and wanting to, more than anything else, move the needle. It is not just about, again, the performance is great. I like getting up on stage now. It's a little different from when I started, but ultimately it's not about putting on a show. It's about doing this work and making doing this work just a thing that we do, and we push things forward and we get fundamental change. We change the material conditions for people, bottom line. So again, be here on October 15th, Repurposing Your Privilege, 1 to 4 p.m. Hope to see you all there.
If you hadn't figured that out, I think someone may have asked, but the actual, and so that's going to be here in the sanctuary. So same bat place, same bat time. So thank you, Mr. Poinsett. Our closing words are by Ma Teresa Tet Gustio Gallardo. Truth manifests itself with its own force. Let us ride on the power of its revelation with a heart ready to receive, to forgive, and to learn. As we extinguish this flame, but not the warmth or the radiance of its glow, take these with you as you go into the world this week and carry them with you until we meet again.